I'm going to talk about, I've been working on national adaptation plans, the national adaptation planning process, and I've been very encouraged in my work on NAPs with a number of different developing countries that when we've talked about resilience, we talk about pulling from different threads of the development portfolio and not taking a single issue approach, but understanding that poverty and health and food security and agriculture, water management, et cetera, all play together in creating this sort of difficult to define thing that is development and robust society and so forth. And having worked at AID for a while, this is not a secret, I don't think. AID and most development agencies are still structured to deal with things one issue at a time. And we create these cross-cutting work streams to try to bring people together. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Roger Mark mentioned the resilience effort at AID, which has been a neat way of bridging the gap between the development and the humanitarian assistance budgets in a couple of places. So when Roger Mark and I were talking about this, this workshop today, I started thinking about the work we've done with NAPs. And I've been working on something called the NAP Global Network. And I'll come to that at the end, but I'm going to start with a few remarks about what are NAPs. So what are they? NAPs were conceived of at the Cancun COP, which was COP 16. And this definition came out of the Durban COP, which was 2011, I think, COP 17. The objectives of national adaptation plans is to reduce vulnerability and to do so by integrating climate adaptation into other things we do. So what that means in shorthand to me is that we stop treating adaptation like a sector and start treating it as a stress or a risk that undermines the development sectors, the economic sectors, the social sectors that we care about. And then the way to do that effectively is not to have an isolated adaptation strategy or an isolated plan, but to weave climate into the things that drive actual planning and decision making and investments. When you start thinking that way, it sounds great. And then you think, okay, how do I get the agriculture minister to take on climate change? Climate is usually housed in the environment ministry. The environment ministry, I think this is not a secret either. The environment ministry is usually not the strongest ministry in most governments. So how do you get the relatively weak environment ministry to get the big powerful ministries, finance, planning, agriculture, transport, energy, tourism, to think about climate change when we've all sort of been indoctrinated that climate is an environment thing. So when you talk to some of these ministers and high-level folks in governments responsible for things like agricultural productivity, or health, education, whatever, you raise climate and say, oh, well, that's those guys. That's the environment ministry. So how do you break down this barrier between the weak ministries that know the issue and the strong ministries that make the decisions and drive the budgets, et cetera? So really, how do you create ownership so that the powerful ministries and the people that lead them feel like climate is their issue and not somebody else's? At a NAP Global Network event a few weeks ago, we pulled these degrees of political support from the health sector. There's expressed commitment where people say, yeah, I'm with you. I think climate is important and I will try to do something about it. That's great. That's a good start. Doesn't necessarily lead to change. And there's institutional commitment. You begin putting policies in place. You begin creating the institutional structures to deal with the issue. And then most important of all, or equally important and sort of the glue that holds the first two together is a budgetary commitment. Things can start to happen when there's funding for it. And if you have the express commitment and the institutional commitment, but you don't have the budgetary commitment, you don't have much. Here's a good example of express commitment from some work that we did in Jamaica. The Minister of Finance, we had a big workshop with we started with about 150 people from across the government and civil society in Jamaica. And I'm going to come to that in a minute. But at the end, I was standing in the back of the room before our final session. Somebody walked up next to me, and we had a Wordle thing up with some of the stuff that we had discussed during the two-day workshop. And it had, you know, water, agriculture, tourism, other things up there, things that the participants had identified as very important for Jamaica's development and things that were at risk of climate impacts. And this person who walked up next to me said, "All right, I get that." And I turned, and it was the Minister of Finance. And I said, "Oh, sir, I'm really glad that you came to this workshop. It was really important to have you here. Your presence really gave the stamp of authority to the event." And he said, "You know, when you invited me, I wanted to know, why do you want me? This is Pickersgill, the Minister of Environment. This is his thing. I don't need to be there. What am I going to say?" And then he said, "Now that I've sat through this for 2 days, I want to know why somebody didn't talk to me about this 20 years ago, because this is clearly my issue as the Minister of Finance as much as it is the Environment Minister's." And he has continued talking this way. I checked with a colleague in the Climate Change Department, and he said, "Oh, yeah, Phillips talks about it as much as the Environment Minister." So the Prime Minister of Jamaica asked aid to help. Jamaica had 6 or 7 different national climate policies that were in different stages of development, and none of them was done. And so none of them were really being implemented because they were all sort of done. And the Prime Minister had created a new climate change, well, she created the Ministry of Water, Land, Environment, and Climate. She created a climate change department. And we had been talking with some in that ministry about the confusion among other elements of the government about what is that ministry's role, vis-a-vis the planning department, which used to be in charge of climate. And in the water authority, the ag ministry, et cetera, nobody knew who to respond to about climate. And so they were just kind of letting it go. So the Prime Minister asked the head of AID in Jamaica if aid would help Jamaica develop a new climate policy. We said yes. We decided that as our starting point, that we wanted to be able to mainstream climate into the things that Jamaica does, rather than creating a separate climate policy that would be owned by the Environment Ministry and perhaps ignored by finance, ag, et cetera. So we started with the Jamaica, the Vision 2030, which came out, I believe, in 2008, maybe 2010. It's a national development plan. It survived 2 elections and changes of party. So it's now a part of the fabric of what Jamaica does. And you probably can't see it, but some of the things that Sandeep was talking about in terms of population dynamics are a part of it. A healthy and national outcomes are on the right. A healthy and stable population, effective social protection, world-class education. The things that to me look like classic economic sectors, which is where the government wanted to focus, are down there in part 3. We have agriculture, manufacturing, mining, construction, et cetera. Down here, number 14 is hazard risk reduction and an adaptation to climate change. So when we talk to people about how are you dealing with climate as you implement the vision, they said, "Oh, well, that's objective 14. It's the Environment Ministry's issue." And there was not a clear way to get it from here up across these other places. So we called this big workshop, like I mentioned earlier, and we took the vision apart. We took the economic components apart. And this was something that my team and I developed at AID. And we wanted to put adaptation, treat it as a stress that would undermine development outcomes. We wanted to start with development objectives. So we took the vision and we took it apart and said, okay, what are the development objectives in the vision? What does it take to create internationally competitive agriculture or a robust tourism sector or whatever? What are the physical inputs? What are the policy conditions, the economic conditions that you need to support that? And then what are the risks and impediments to those things? Where is there going to be a climate disruption? And where are there other problems that are not climate? And this is where the idea of resilience comes in, because we wanted to make sure that people were considering the multiple impediments that would undermine achieving development goals. And then down there at the bottom is thinking about solutions. This would be an iterative process. You wouldn't do all of this. You wouldn't identify all solutions in a two-day workshop, but you would get people thinking and then go back in more and more detail as you identify priorities up there at the top. This is what it looked like when we did it. Again, it may be a little hard to see, but this is a flip chart. We put agriculture, one of the sectors that was in the vision here. We had tables of about 8 or 10 people taking the vision priorities apart and doing what I showed in the previous one. These are the inputs. We had mixed, those 10 people were not all from the ag ministry. They were from across different sectors. This woman who led this session was from the opposition party, and she was a health expert, but she was at the ag table. This is what it looked like up close. One of the key inputs for achieving agricultural outcomes is a robust crop and livestock sector, and you can, you probably can't see, stress is arrayed around it. The red ones are climate related, the black ones are non-climate. This is it a little bit more formal. Again, you can see the energy, water, and crops, livestock, and fisheries were identified as physical inputs, access to credit and finance, and a legal and regulatory framework were identified as enabling conditions. Then we took each of those and broke them down further, and we said, okay, what can you do to resolve the climate stresses that we've talked about, and who's responsible? And we kept seeing the Ministry of Water, Land, Environment, and Climate come up as a key actor in this. And they were one that 3 or 4 months earlier, people said some of the folks in the other agencies weren't aware that it fully existed. They didn't know how to access them, but they were able to say that they would be important, and particularly important was the Met Service, the National Weather Service, who provided information. So Jamaica is hopefully almost done with a national policy. That it's not a single policy. They created an adaptation and mitigation policy framework that charges each of the ministries responsible for the key components of the vision with developing an action plan that would address climate risks and opportunities for reducing emissions. They have identified 26 focal points across the government, and so now the responsibility is shared across the government. It's not just the minister or the ministry. And we had a bit of a debate with the minister over what it would mean to put responsibility, whether he held responsibility or pushed it out to some of the other ministers. And he eventually agreed that he would not have any authority over the energy ministry, for example, to get them to implement his priorities. So he was willing to share. So then, with those 26 focal points, we began working with the Wilson Center. And we did a training for them. We took the same basic approach, but we asked the key focal points, or the 26 focal points, what's your ministry's mission statement? What are you responsible for as a representative of these ministries or agencies? What's success for you? Who depends on you? So if you're an ag extension, farmers depend on you. Who do you depend on? The Met Service, ag research, the general ministry, et cetera. What inputs and conditions do you need? You need a budget, you need computers, you need trucks, you need gasoline, et cetera. What do you need? What constitutes, what are the inputs you need to succeed? And then again, what are the risks and impediments? So we wanted them to start thinking about the idea here of who do you depend on and who depends on you, was to start putting together multi-sectoral teams so that they could write these sectoral adaptation plans with the right people at the table. We were doing that exercise in Kingston in 2012 that the minister was at. A colleague of mine and I were both floating around checking to make sure that the conversation was moving. And he went to the he went to the tourism table, and they had a great array of the sticky charts, sticky notes like I showed you. And he said, hey, there's nothing there about transportation. How do the tourists get to the hotels? And they said, oh, we've got a good coastal road network. We're not worried about that. And he said, okay. And he walked over to the transportation table, and they were deciding that the best thing they could do was to stop investing in coastal road maintenance. As the roads degraded and got destroyed, they would rebuild them inland where they wouldn't have to rebuild them every hurricane season. So Mike walked back to the tourism table and said, hey, you know what? That road network that you have not addressed in your list of key inputs, they're getting rid of it over there. So somebody stood up and walked over, and they've begun talking, and now transport is being engaged in tourism. On an earlier trip down there when we were setting up the workshop, I was the one who broke the news to the head of the tourism department that the Ministry of Energy had gotten a permit for a coal-fired power plant in a protected area. And the head of tourism pulled out a poster that they had just gotten printed that was showing, it was promoting inland tourism. They're trying to move the tourists away from the coast in the protected area where the coal-fired power plant had just been approved to be built. And she said, nobody wants to go hiking near a power plant. What? We told them we needed energy, but not this. So they're starting to talk. So this is what Jamaica's doing. They're developing 12 of these sector work plans that address mitigation and adaptation. Those sector work plans are meant to feed into the, I think it's 5-year and 3-year medium and short-term work plans to implement the vision. Already underway are the forestry plan, the agriculture plan, and there was a workshop last week or the week before in Jamaica on climate smart ag and fisheries. USAID is supporting forestry and agriculture. The 5Cs, the Caribbean Community Climate Change Center, thank you, is supporting the fisheries one with EU support, EU funding. And then the ones that will come up over the next couple of years are you can read them. And they're being supported by different donors, but the donors and the Ministry of the Climate Department are setting up sort of standard operating procedures so that the, you know, a PPCR funded plan will be comparable in appearance and in understandability to one that's supported by AID or the EU. So now to the NAP Global Network. This was, like I said, we started this, maybe I didn't say this. This was launched at the Lima COP last December. And the idea was that as NAPs take off, most developing countries are beginning to work on these. There's no defined template for a national adaptation plan the way there was for a national adaptation plan of action, a NAPA. And in some of the meetings I've been at, there's like a discomfort with some of the developing countries that it's not clear what their NAP should look like or when it's going to be done or what they have to do with it. And the NAPAs were largely led by multilaterals. And we realized the U.S. talking with Germany and Japan and Britain and other donors that have big bilateral agencies as well, realize that we're all working on these. We're trying to, each of the bilateral donors, AID and GIZ and DFID and JICA, et cetera, are trying to figure out how we provide support, how we coordinate with each other. So Daritza's comment about the lack of coordination. I was in the Caribbean earlier this year for one of these meetings, trying to encourage coordination. We found that USAID and DFID were both supporting a beach replenishment project on the same beach and didn't know it, and we had been working there for several years. And the government of this country was also still issuing sand mining licenses for the same beach. So often the coordination barrier is not that high. It's just getting the right three people in the room together to say, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening and we didn't know it. So the idea was that we could share lessons among the donors. We could also enable, Jamaica has great experience with this. They are to a degree out in front of other developing countries. The Philippines has done a fantastic job and is way out front. So we also wanted to enable countries to learn from each other. And we wanted to also make sure that, to do a better job about making sure that our field offices, the bilateral donor field offices, know something about NAPS, know that they're important diplomatically to the US, to Germany, et cetera, to the whole world, really. They're a keystone piece of the adaptation negotiations. And so we pulled together in this network, and it's going to be rolling out over the next 2 or 3 years. We had our first, what we call targeted topic forum at the beginning of July. The topic was building political support for NAPS, and then helping people figure out how to write these integrated or mainstream sector plans. We had about 10 countries. We tried to get everybody to bring teams of three. Somebody, the climate focal point, but also a sector lead and somebody from the finance or planning department. So we would have the climate expertise, the sector that we wanted to influence, and then the money and the sort of national support. We also tried to bring in people from the donor agencies so that we would be aware of what the countries are trying to achieve so that our work could better support it. I will stop there, and you can either finish your lunch or ask questions or whatever you'd like. Thank you for your time.